Welcome to the Reimagining Podcast. I'm Theodore Richards. The Reimagining Podcast is a production of Wisdom Projects Incorporated, a 501c3 nonprofit organization which includes the Baltimore Wisdom Project and the Chicago Wisdom Project. Our shared mission is to reimagine education and reimagine the world by enhancing the lives of youth and adults with holistic education, intercultural understanding, and anti-oppressive, liberationist thought leadership. William Ayers, formerly Distinguished Professor of Education and Senior University Scholar at the University of Illinois at Chicago, UIC, and founder of both the Small Schools Workshop and the Center for Youth and Society, is a graduate of the University of Michigan, Bank Street College of Education, Bennington College, and Teachers College, Columbia University. Ayers has written extensively about social justice, democracy, and education, the cultural context of schooling, teaching as an essentially intellectual, ethical, and political enterprise. He is the former vice president of the curriculum division of the American Educational Research Association. His articles have appeared in many journals, including the Harvard Educational Review, Teachers College Record, Rethinking Schools, Educational Leadership, and the Cambridge Journal of Education. His books include Demand the Impossible, Teaching with Conscience in an Imperfect World, Teaching Toward Freedom, A Kind and Just Parent, Teaching the Personal and the Political, Fugitive Days, Public Enemy, To Teach, The Journey in Comics with Ryan Alexander Tanner, Teaching the Taboo with Rick Ayers, Race Course with Bernadine Dorn, and most recently, You Can't Fire the Bad Ones and Other Myths About Teachers with Crystal Laura and Rick Ayers. Bill, welcome to Reimagining.
It's good to hear your voice, Ted. Nice to be with you.
So there's a lot for us to get to. I wanted to kind of start with just a question about really the how and why of education for you personally. A lot of people know your work kind of as an activist and working, fighting against imperialism, racism, fascism, and other isms that we have out here. So what was the impetus to go into education, and how for you is activism expressed through education?
Yeah, I think that I have an interesting trajectory into teaching because I didn't start off to be a teacher. In 1965, I was part of the civil rights movement, the Black Freedom Movement of that time, and I was part of the anti-war movement. And I was arrested in 1965 inside a draft board in Ann Arbor, Michigan, along with 39 other people, protesting the war in Vietnam and trying to shut down the kind of machinery of war making, but also to draw a screaming kind of attention onto the fact that our government was committing genocide in Vietnam. So I was arrested in 1965. I went to jail. I did 10 days in jail. And in jail, I met some folks who were founding a small freedom school in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And so I marched out of jail and into my first teaching job. Now, that's not everybody's trajectory into teaching, but it was my trajectory. And for that reason, teaching has always had a very strong and solid link to social justice. It's never for me been a separate kind of event, like we teach and then we think about social justice. Mm-hmm. They are absolutely intertwined in my experience and in my life. So I went into this small freedom school, and I had no intention of becoming a teacher, but I started hanging out there. And within a year, I was a full-time teacher. And shortly after that, I was the director of this small school. I was 20 years old. But the draw was that I had no idea that I would either enjoy or be profoundly influenced by working with kids, but both were true. And so I never left. And I became a teacher then in 1965. And in one way or another, I've been a teacher ever since. But what powered our teaching then was a sense that teaching kind of stands on the twin pillars of enlightenment and liberation. That is, we need to know more, the enlightenment part. We need to understand more. We need to grasp more. And in an infinite and expanding universe, you can never know everything. So you're always striving to learn more, to know more. And why are you learning more? So that you can do more, so that you can be freer, so that you can participate in the liberation of humanity and learn how to live in a way that's sustainable, that's universally understood. And so that's my experience. And the freedom schools, the thing we drew on most explicitly was the freedom schools from Mississippi. And this became kind of a touch point for me as a teacher. Freedom schools were founded in Mississippi during the civil rights movement. And it was in a lull in the civil rights movement. You know, the way we often tell the story is kind of an upward trajectory that just was, you know, never varied. But that's not true. In all movements, there's upward motion and falling back. There's mountain times and there's valley times. So during a valley time in the freedom movement in the South, a young volunteer from Howard University with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee made a proposal that the movement develop freedom schools throughout the South. And in the founding document, and this document was really widely read. It was Xerox. That's a word people don't know anymore, but you can Google it. Not now, but sometime. But he copied this document. It was a page and a half proposal, not a proposal to the MacArthur Foundation or the government, a proposal to friends and colleagues and comrades. And the document basically said, the Black people of Mississippi have been denied many things, forward-looking curriculum, fully trained teachers, decent facilities. But the fundamental injury is they've been denied the right to think for themselves about the circumstances of their lives and how they could be otherwise. Now think about that as a statement in Mississippi in 1966, 67, 65. Actually, the Mississippi Freedom School curriculum, you can find it online. It's 1964, now that I think about it. But think of that statement. We've been denied many things, but the fundamental injury is a right to think for ourselves about the circumstances of our lives. Who are we? How did we get here? And how they might be otherwise? Where do we want to go? That question could be the same question we ask kids on the west side of Chicago, in Watts in Los Angeles, in the South Bronx. What are the circumstances of our lives and how could they be otherwise? This volunteer's indictment of the schools was basically to say they've stunted intellectual curiosity. They've stunted real thinking. Now, this was a revolutionary proposal because, if you think about it, because they were actually saying, we encourage you, Black people, Black kids of Mississippi, to think about overthrowing the feudal system that you live under. And if you don't think it was revolutionary, remember that the three martyrs of Mississippi, Goodman, Schwerner, and Cheney, were lynched. They were all freedom school teachers, and they had been investigating the arson bombing of a freedom school when they were kidnapped and lynched. So there's no question that this was revolutionary, that it challenged the status quo. That kind of image, that model of what school could be, has powered my teaching from 1965 to today.
A lot there. That's great, Bill. It's so interesting to hear you say all of that, given the way that we've watched sort of the place and role of our public schools and our public school system today. And, you know, as you put it, when you talked about enlightenment, it's always a process. For one, it's always a process of continual change and transformation all around us, evolution, and we're always learning, capable of learning and needing to learn new things given our circumstance. It really struck me to hear that when we think about the kind of direction that our schools have gone today, and we look at the current debates about our schools today with this sort of hyper-focus on these kind of concise skills and very narrow range of knowledge that's supposed to be able to be tested for and then transferred into some sort of quantifiable outcome, right? And we think of education, we've sort of reduced it down from this sort of really expansive notion that you talked about to this sort of really narrow kind of view of the world and narrow view of what's possible in a school system.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is, I should say it's always been true. That is the struggle over education, and it's true in our culture, in our society, but it's true around the world. Education is a site of social struggle always, because education is where we decide who we are as a people, what we want for our children, and schools therefore mirror and are a window onto any social structure. Anywhere you go in the world, you could go to fascist Germany or apartheid South Africa or medieval Saudi Arabia. If you looked at their schools, you'd know what kind of a culture and society they had. If you knew the kind of society they had, you could predict what the schools would look like. And that's been true universally. So you go to South Africa under apartheid and you have classrooms of 50, 60 kids in a broken down shack learning obedience and conformity. That reflects apartheid. You go to Germany in 1935, 38, and sure, you have, they produce excellent scientists, excellent athletes and artists. They also produce a culture that's obedient and conforming and willing to turn the other way when people are marched into the ovens. That's the kind of school system they had. That's the kind of society they had. So we could look at ourselves and say, What do our schools look like? What does that tell us about society? You're absolutely right that the kind of notion of a freedom school as built on the pillars of liberation and enlightenment is not at all what we see in the majority of schools. We see a class-ridden school system. We see a racially divided school system. And for the people of privilege, they get access to not only materials and ways of thinking and so on that are advanced and expansive. And kids from traditionally oppressed groups, poor kids, immigrants from poor countries, the children of formerly enslaved people, these folks get, the children of indigenous people, these folks get a, not only a second and third class education, but their education is one of conformity, obedience, learning your place in the pyramid of life and being taught that you must accept it. If you think about it, in a democracy, obedience and conformity would be banished. In a true democracy, we would want to foreground the qualities of curiosity, attentiveness, imagination, dreaming, and entrepreneurship, initiative, courage, those kinds of qualities. But to the extent that we look at schools for poor kids and we see an overemphasis on behavior modification, an overemphasis on standardized testing, which basically line kids up into winners and losers, we should be very skeptical that we then are looking at a democratic society with a school system that reflects the values of democracy. I'm skeptical of that.
It's an absolute, there's a huge chasm, isn't there, between the way that the privileged in our society educate their children. And many of them are, many of those elites are advocating that we have these sort of punitive, draconian, very rigid, sort of control-focused school settings for our poor children, and yet they don't have those same expectations for their own children.
Absolutely right. I mean, and I think that one useful kind of exercise is to ask, what do the most privileged and the wisest parents have for their children? Mm-hmm. And then say, that's what we as a baseline should have for all of our children in a democratic community. In other words, whatever the Arnie Duncans and Michael Bloombergs and Barack Obamas and George Bushes have for their kids should be a minimum for what we want for all of our kids. So to take one example from our neighborhood, Arnie Duncan, who was a major cheerleader for 12 years, head of the Chicago schools for 4 years, head of the nation schools for 8 years. And he promoted a program of testing, a program of undermining teachers' associations, teachers' unions, a program of reducing education to one single score on a standardized test, and allowing the public space to be organized as a private space or to be transformed into a private space. That's what he advocated for 12 years. When he moved back to Chicago from Washington, D.C., he couldn't find a single public school to put his kid into. So where did he put his kid? Put his kid into the lab school. Well, why is that? Because the lab school has a full arts program, tiny classes, 12 kids to a class, a de-emphasis of standardized testing, a teacher's union that's fully supported, and teachers who are honored. That's the school he wants for his kid. We should demand that that hypocrisy be recognized, and that if you want that for your kids, why don't we have that as the baseline for everybody's kids? I mean, one of the things that really drives me nuts is the reliance of that group of people, those so-called school reformers, on standardized testing, which everyone knows is a fraud. That standardized testing is a fraud from top to bottom. But I'll tell you the way that I understand it these days, that's helpful to me at least, is I borrow something from economic theory called Goodhart's Law. And Goodhart's Law in economics holds that a performance metric only works as a performance metric if you don't use it as a performance metric.
Yeah.
Now catch the contradiction there.
Yeah.
A performance metric only works as a performance metric if you don't use it as a performance metric. And here's what I'll give you two quick examples.
It's like quantum physics, right? If you observe it.
Physics has the same law. And in economics, it's called Goodhart's Law. And I think in physics, it's called the uncertainty principle. But the point is the same. And that is that if you say to yourself, I want a good hospital, and the measure of a good hospital is going to be one performance metric, how long do people live after major heart surgery? And the metric says if they live 30 days, that's a good metric. So you notice that all over the United States, Presbyterian Hospital can keep people alive for 30 days. That's easy, right? Yeah. On days 31 through 40, people are dropping like flies, but they get to say, I'm a good hospital because they met that performance metric, and every energy is built towards making that metric come true. In Chicago, we have a charter school called Urban Prep. Urban Prep decided that they wanted to be a great high school. So what they decided was that their performance metric would be sends kids to college. Well, guess what? Urban Prep sends 100% of their kids to college. Now, what is a college? Well, Rose's Beauty School, a for-profit college, you know, a university the kids drop out of in a year, and so on. They sent their kids to college, but they don't actually build a good high school. They've bent every effort towards this performance metric, and they failed to create a school that you would want to send your kids to. So that's the kind of thing that we see again and again. People striving to meet the standardized test benchmarks that people like Arne Duncan have promoted, and not really concerning themselves with the complexity of what it means to build a decent school, and certainly not a school that Arne Duncan or Barack Obama would send their kids to.
Just to take a step back a little bit and to sort of figure out, you know, how we get to this place of reductionism and focus so much on testing. And some of it has to do with sort of, I think, just to be perfectly blunt, just sort of just generally kind of classist and racist notions about controlling certain classes and kinds of people, right? I think there's some of that at play. I think there's also, at the same time, there's this sort of technocratic lack of imagination that's at play here in terms of what happens in a school and what sort of makes a school a vibrant place that where a person wants to learn. And also this not really getting, I think this is such an important point you brought up earlier, I want to go back to it, not really getting that a school actually does function as a, describe it as a metaphor for the world or a microcosm of the world.
Like absolutely.
Think about a school or a classroom even. We take it down to a classroom because that's the space, particularly for younger children, that in which their learning happens. If we think about, rather than thinking about like getting an outcome that we can, that's small and narrow, think about the world and then think about how we can create that world that we want to envision in the learning space.
Right. Yes. I think that's absolutely right. I think that there is a technocratic aspect. I'll add a third aspect to the drive towards standardized testing, and that is the desperation of parents, particularly parents whose kids have been cheated in our educational system. The desperation as they look at a hostile job market and a hostile society, and they ask themselves, how can I get ahead? How can I get my kid an education? I'm not interested in some long-term solution. I need it now. And the simplicity of the standardized test score, the ability to take it off the shelf is seductive. So I think all of these things contribute, but I think it's a time for us, what in all the debates in education that are going on, and I think this time in particular where we're living through in a major transformative crisis, but I think it's time to, underneath all these arguments, to look at a basic argument and or a basic question, let me say, which is this: is education a product to be sold at the marketplace, or is education a human right that everyone has access to simply by being born? If it's a human right, we're doing things all wrong. If it's a product, well, things like vouchers and charter schools and test scores and undermining teachers' unions, okay, they might make sense on a cost-benefit analysis. But that's not what education is. You look at Article 26 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which says that every child in the world, the late 1940s, every child in the world has a right to an education geared towards development of the full human personality. Not a word about test scores, not a word about sorting people between winners and losers, but rather a sense that each of us has this right simply by being born. And frankly, I think we're in a moment where we're going to have to look at the world through new eyes, and we're going to have to ask ourselves in what ways, you know, is human rights, for example, a right to water, a right to food, a right to housing?
Yeah, I mean, it strikes me as, again, you know, some of that, it feels like there's a little bit of a lack of imagination in the sense that there are those who would reduce our education to this kind of like, is it a product, you know, like,
exactly.
I mean, some of that is really, I think, somewhat, you know, people are aware of what they're doing in some cases. I mean, because I think we do have like, there is a certain worldview that is espoused by many people who've advocated for these measures in schools that really do think of the world and term in these sort of like transactional kind of ways. Think right. of the, it's, everything is reduced down to these sort of like this like hyper-capitalist, hyper-individualist, competitive worldview, right? And that's their vision of the world. And so they bring it down into a classroom space, and you get this space in which you're just sort of like competing for each other and competing for resources and competing with each other. I suppose it's profoundly threatening to think of the notion that, you know, it's much easier to control people by pitting them against one another, right? And it becomes a little bit scary when you think about a classroom space as a liberatory space in which people are trying to lift one another up.
Well, exactly. And I think you're absolutely right to point to, for example, a kind of weaponized individualism to the extent that the public is erased from the equation altogether. There's no such thing as the public. We begin to have a political conversation where public safety involves me owning a gun and nothing else. Public education is what I can buy. Public is not only kind of disappeared, but to the extent that people use public, it becomes coded for racial, public welfare, public transportation, public hospital, mm-hmm. public housing. These are racialized terms in the modern context. But I think it's hugely important to notice what you're saying. That is that if you reduce education to a transactional experience, you've lost what education is in the sense of enlightenment and liberation. So one of the things that drove me nuts a few years ago during the Obama administration was they floated an idea out of the education department that they would be evaluating colleges based on how students did economically 10 years out of school. Then, in other words, you go to Harvard, you go to Howard, you go to the University of Illinois, and 10 years later, we'll see how you're doing economically, and that's how we'll judge whether you got a decent education. Now, that defies everything that I believe, and I believe you believe, about education, because you can be sure, first of all, that the graduates of Harvard are going to be making more money than the graduates of Howard or Penn State. But you can also be sure that the poets are going to be making less money than the financiers, and the actors are going to be making less than the lawyers. Exactly, exactly. So, and the teachers are going to be making less than the business graduate. So it's an odd way to think about what an education is, the reduction to not only a transactional, but a material, capitalistic kind of notion of winners and losers, but also on a very thin metric, and that is income in the case of the proposal around colleges, or test scores in the case of what we're all living through.
Yeah, there are a number of problems with that, quite obviously. But you know, one of the most obvious things that comes to mind is you know, in addition to the difference between different institutions and the different kind of access a person has to making more money, just the notion that somehow success is equal to income in some
exactly.
way. Rather than sort of like this notion that one's success could be related to an ability to contribute something meaningful to a community. I mean, there's another way to do it. But you know, it's like, it's this whole thing about when we need to assess something in the most politically expedient way, sometimes it's harder to assess something like contribution to a community, but with a very clear cut metric, right?
So, but then the question is, why do we need to assess it?
That's the question.
Who are we assessing it for? One of the things that I think Marx, as a lifelong teacher, one of the things that I think Marx a decent sense of evaluation is that it involves the people who are being evaluated have to participate in the making of the standards. You can't impose the standards from Washington or Springfield or Wall Street. You have to say, what are the standards we as a community care about? And then you find measures of happiness and measures of fulfillment and measures of community involvement becoming much more important. And the question then becomes, why do we actually need to measure these things? If we live in a intergenerational, intercultural, cooperative society, aren't we all contributing in the ways we can? And again, in a crisis like the one we're living through right this minute, we see the best and the worst of what we're capable of in our society coming to the fore. And you can look at it. You can look at the contradictions. You can look at what's exposed. And you can look at the decency of people trying to solve a collective problem in a collective way.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in a moment.
Our statement of intent. One, the planet and humanity are at a moment of crisis and opportunity and of transition. Two, because we are entering into an unknown future, imagination is paramount. Three, this moment requires new stories, new narratives, new creative works that express this reimagining. Four, we believe that these narratives must challenge and confront the injustices of our day. Five, the crisis of the moment is an educational crisis. That is, we must reimagine educational processes in order to reimagine our narratives. Six, we welcome educators, poets, philosophers, activists, and writers who are interested in reimagining ourselves and our relationship to the planet. Seven, reimagining is a place not so much to find quick answers or definitive solutions. Rather, it is a place to ask big questions, to explore possibilities, and to imagine a new world. You can find more about our work at www.reimaginingmagazine.com and more about our broader mission at www.chicagowisdomproject.org and www.baltimorewisdomproject.org.
Hi, we're back. I'm talking with educator and activist Bill Ayers. Let's kind of situate the questions that we've been discussing about education. Let's situate them in this moment. And we can talk about coronavirus, but more broadly, we can talk about, some of the very same factors that are at play in coronavirus are exposing problems with capitalism, problems with people who are on the margins economically, problems with climate change, and also the rise of fascist governments worldwide. We're certainly experiencing some of the problems with fascist leaders denying climate change and denying coronavirus at the same time.
Yeah.
So curious to talk about kind of like how we started the conversation talking about the freedom schools and there's particular context in Mississippi, and some things haven't changed since then and others have. And what do you see kind of like right now at this moment? There's certainly no letting up from those who are in power in terms of how they try to manage and control a school system.
Let's broaden it. Yeah, you're right about it. It's not just a school system, though. It's also a healthcare system. It's mm-hmm. a production system. It's a transportation system. It's a housing system. It's a food delivery system. I mean, one of the things that I think is very clear is that people with power, wealthy people, you could call them the 1% and their government enablers, the 1% always has an agenda, and it's always hammering on that agenda day in and day out. When a crisis hits, whether it's 9/11 or the 2008 recession or the coronavirus, they pull their most ambitious plans out of the bottom drawer and go straight to work. In 9/11, that meant transferring massive amounts of wealth from taxpayers into big corporations. It meant rolling out a surveillance state. It meant going to war. That's what it meant. It meant those things quite concretely. And what was astonishing for those of us who were still looking with bewilderment at the skies above us was that they had a big, thick book of things they could do. So
their plans are already right there sitting on their desk, right? They're in the bottom here. Yeah. Yeah, we got a plan to evade Iraq. Let's do it.
Absolutely. They were in the bottom drawer. They pulled it out and they pulled it off. I think those of us who are in the resistance or in the opposition are in a better place today than we were during 9/11. And I could explain why that's true. A lot of it has to do with the social movements that have grown up in the last decade, Black Lives Matter, Undocumented and Unafraid, the Women's Rising, and so on. But look what we're facing right now. The agenda of privatizing the public space is on steroids. The agenda of surveilling us, of controlling us, of disappearing the public. And you just pointed to one of the huge ones, and that is the moving forward of an authoritarian kind of government against any democratic, any impulse towards democracy and participation. So you look at Viktor Orban, or you look at Modi in India, or Netanyahu, they have shown us what they're going to do. Orban dissolves the parliament. Modi locks down giant sections of his country. Netanyahu basically takes power unto himself. What is Trump going to do? The authoritarian impulse is fully there. So at the same time, there are people all over the world who've been building a resistance to this authoritarianism. And we also are in motion. We should be much clearer and much more forceful at putting forward an agenda. But here are the kind of contradictions that struck me right away when this thing hit. The Chicago Public Schools announced with great fanfare in February that they were going to put soap in the children's restroom. And you're like, what? There was no soap in the bathrooms? Are you kidding me? Yes. And then Detroit announces with great pride that they're going to stop turning off water to poor people. Wait, what? Water is a product. It's not a right. And you just turn it off and now you're going to turn it back on. Prisoners. I mean, I have a very dear friend, as you know, in New York State prisons. He's been there 38 years. The prisons are a hotspot for coronavirus. The focus in the media is on the cruise ships, but the prisons are in even much worse shape than the cruise ships. People are locked together. There's no opportunity for social distancing. The food is bad. The air is bad, and they are doomed. And so why, I think it was in Iran that they were able to release some huge, like a third of their prison population in just a matter of weeks. So they released 70,000 prisoners out of 240,000. In the United States, where we have 2.3 million people in prison, if we did the same thing Iran did, we would release 765,000 prisoners. Yeah. That would be a beginning. No child should be in prison. No person awaiting trial but not convicted should be sitting in a county jail. No pregnant woman should be in prison. No person over 55 should be in prison. These are things that governors could do right now if they had the political courage, and we should press for these things right now. So I think that the contradictions of capitalism are fully available. In fact, in some ways, Naomi Klein wrote about disaster capitalism and how during a crisis, people in power have all kinds of methods for enriching themselves. But in many ways, it's not disaster capitalism, although that is what we're looking at. It's that we have to realize that capitalism is the disaster. That is,
yeah.
It's absolutely true. Capitalism has always been built on sacrificing life for profit. The transatlantic slave trade, the environmental catastrophe that we're facing. This is a sacrificial exercise of human life for profit for a few. I have a little piece that I do on my blog called Why You Wouldn't Make a Good Capitalist. And it's got all kinds of things in there, like you would not in your wildest dreams manipulate the price of a drug that people need to stay alive. You wouldn't do it. So you wouldn't make a good capitalist. You wouldn't violate the automobile standards for pollution in order to make an extra nickel. You wouldn't frack all of Pennsylvania in order to get a few drops of oil. You just wouldn't do it. So one of the things we have to look at is the ways in which capitalism is itself the disaster. And we should look in this moment for why universal health care makes absolute sense, why water should not be a product that's charged for, why housing, here's another contradiction. You know, you go to Oakland or here in Chicago, you see the unhoused everywhere. And you see them living in conditions that are dire and difficult. And you look at the privileged people like us who can have a conversation online. And you say to yourself, why are so many people unhoused? And again, housing is not a human right in our country. Housing is a product. And we're unwilling to build the kinds of housing stock that we need. But you go to a place like Oakland or Chicago, and you see, or Las Vegas, there are more empty apartments and empty hotel rooms than there are people living on the street. Mm-hmm. How can that be? How can we allow that to be the norm, that we have more housing in Oakland than we do unhoused people? Why can't we fix that?
You've gone back to kind of some of the real roots of this kind of way of thinking, the way of thinking that leads to the absurdity of privatizing a school system, right? Or privatizing a forest, right? I mean, you're talking about
Absolutely.
Land and ownership. These are like, and you very rightly mentioned the transatlantic slave trade as sort of co-arising with capitalism. It was in some ways for Europeans as they were creating this system and exploiting people the world around and exploiting natural resources the world around. They were able to, in some ways, align themselves and one another to what they were doing and the real kind of damage that was being done by dehumanizing the other in those contexts. These kind of fundamental contradictions, as you said, like between this notion of freedom and individual rights, right, which we also talk about all the time, and then also the need to kind of destroy and exploit at the same time. These contradictions are coming, I think, increasingly kind of close to the point of irreconcilability.
And, I agree. And, you know, yes, I agree.
Let's talk a little bit, because we've just got a little bit of time left. I want to kind of think then about, like, you can see, I think, in our schools, the sort of clinging to this worldview, clinging to this notion of, like, we have to, like, really think about competition and individual success and quantifiable outcomes and these sort of really draconian policies in schools. Let's talk a little bit more about, like, what's on the other side, possibly. Like, what's your vision for, if you could reimagine, just say, a classroom, a learning space, or maybe even a, you know, like, what do you see as a way to kind of counter those values, those capitalist values?
Well, you know, you mentioned at the outset that I wrote a book called Teaching with Conscience in an Imperfect World. And in that book, what I try to do is imagine the kinds of things that actually already exist that could be brought to the foreground and become what powers our educational enterprise rather than things that are put in the margins. And that includes things like foregrounding imagination. If I were building a school, a classroom, or a school system, I would absolutely refer back to the Freedom Schools. One way of imagining the Freedom Schools as a universal kind of template is to think about that great Paul Gauguin painting, which I first encountered in the Boston Museum. Gauguin, you know, was a French Impressionist and driven mad, lived in the Pacific Islands, and terrified of modernism. And one of his greatest canvases is a collage with all kinds of weird, spiritual and odd kind of images, a Virgin Mary who's an old hag, a triangle with an eye, all kinds of things, a goat, a dog. But Gauguin painted on the collage a huge, the title of the painting, he scrawled it on the thing. And in English, to translate it, it was written in French, but what it says is, what are we? Where do we come from? And where are we going? To me, those would be the three questions that I would have power my classrooms from preschool through high school. We want to ask the profound questions. What are we? What do we owe each other? What is our responsibility to one another? What does our future want to look like? What kind of society would we like to live in? These kinds of ethical, moral questions should power education from preschool through graduate school. And it doesn't matter if you're learning science, if you're learning math, you're not learning math because of its inherent greatness, although it's inherently wonderful. You're learning math in order to become more capable of understanding, grasping, and participating in the universe we live in. So I think those things, yes, I think those things could come forward. And not only could they come forward, but I would argue that in many ways, classrooms in the United States, schools in the United States, are contested spaces, always have been. And we've seen some of the most hopeful things come out of here in Chicago, where Chicago teachers banded together and led two absolutely historic work stoppages. And they weren't demanding simply more wages and more benefits, although they deserved that. They were demanding to save public education from the vicious forces that are trying to privatize it and undo it. That is really exciting. And that energy sped to West Virginia, Colorado, Los Angeles, Arizona. And now it's part of the world conversation about where are we going in education. I'm super hopeful that the struggles against the kind of privatization and the kind of reduction of education to a transactional, simple metric are actually underway. And I think we're going to come through the existing crisis in a better place than we were before 5 years ago, say.
Yeah, it seems that a lot of the movement among teachers, I mean, like you say, for sure, it's about, you know, better pay and things like that in part, which they deserve. But it's also about being taken, in some senses, taken seriously as thinkers, as intellectuals in the Gramscian sense, right? Like thinking Absolutely. About how they can really participate, you know, in the process and their earned and learned wisdom from being there working with children in these spaces should be listened to. And similarly, our young people too should be listened to.
Well, absolutely. I've argued my whole life as a teacher that teaching is intellectual and ethical work. And often teachers kind of recoil at that because they don't want to be so lofty. But in reality, Teaching requires a thinking, caring person at its center. It is intellectual work in the Gramscian sense. And I think that what we saw in the Chicago teacher actions, the teacher strikes, we saw banners all over the city that said, every kid deserves arts education. Every kid deserves a librarian. Every kid deserves a counselor and a social worker. They were not striking for the narrowest things. They were striking to say our kids here in Chicago, poor kids, black and brown kids, deserve what the privileged kids at the Lab School or Francis Parker School have. They deserve the arts. They deserve teachers who are committed and well-paid. They deserve an education of value so that they can become valuable people.
And as an extension of that, I think we all deserve to hear what they can offer once we do create a space for them to pursue these really serious questions of That's when we, really learn, because the reality is, I think if we look at our world scene today, we've certainly heard a lot from the people that have, the people in the Ivy League and the people with PhDs and the people on Wall Street, and we hear what they have to offer to the world. It would be worth listening to those who have not previously been listened to, because they can offer new ways of seeing things, right?
There's no question about it. And I think that, we can take that even further. We need to listen to the voices from Palestine. We need to listen to the voices from Kashmir. We need to listen to the voices from the barrios in Mexico City. There are voices we need to listen to. But one of the things that I've done that you bring to my mind, I've always done this. Whenever the Chicago Public Schools do something that I find egregious, I go down to the University of Chicago Laboratory Schools and ask how they do the same thing. One simple, And it's in that spirit of saying, what do the most privileged have? So one example is that when the Chicago Public Schools many years ago banned the graphic novel Persepolis, which was a story of coming of age in Iran when it was going through the Islamic Revolution, they banned it. And why did they ban it? Because on one page, somewhere deep in the book, some little boy is peeing in the street and you can see his penis. So they banned it. So I went down to the University of Chicago Lab School and I said, do you guys have Persepolis in the library? Oh yeah, we have 12 copies, 2 in the original French. And I said, do the kids read it? Yes, all seventh graders are required to read it. So here we have the privilege of getting real art, real literature, and we have the kids in Chicago Public Schools getting one more hour of drill and kill. That's the kind of thing we have to compare and contrast and say, this isn't right. But more to the point, when the Chicago Public Schools the teachers were fighting against having their evaluations based so extensively on standardized test scores of their children, I went to the lab school and we had a long talk about how teachers are evaluated. I won't give you the long version, but I talked to the head of the union and the head of the school for 2 hours. And they have a very elaborate system of inducting people into their teaching core, of raising the question, what is good teaching, not only on grade levels and disciplines, but also with parents and kids. They have people coming in and asking that profound question, what makes good teaching? Again and again, at the end of 2 hours, I said to them, and what role does standardized tests play in evaluating teachers? And they looked at me like I was from Mars and they said, what do standardized tests have to do with good teaching? Ah, thank you very much, people of the privileged. But the underprivileged, the kids who are not given those assets and the teachers who work with those kids have to face this kind of cruel system that is rejected by the people who have the power to reject it.
Bill, thanks so much for being here and reimagining. Thanks for your work and your passion. And we'll continue the conversation another time. Thanks so much.
Yes, let's do, Ted. Talk to you soon.
All right. Okay. Bye-bye. Thanks, Bill.
The Reimagining Podcast with Theodore Richards is a production of Wisdom Projects Incorporated. Original music by Cosmos Ray. Sound engineering by Jim Qualick. Thank you for listening and for reimagining with us.